Can you hear me?
Yeah, if you can be a slightly more centered.
No, because what you can't see is there's a wall.
Oh, okay. That works then. All right.
Girl, that's about as far as I can go.
That's fine. That works. Okay, and so we're going to mute you and stop your video. And when we start at 11, you'll just have to click accept start video.
Okay.
Okay. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. All right. See you in a few minutes. All right. I'm opening it up to attendees.
Hello, we'll be getting going in a second. We will be starting in a minute. We're waiting for Senator Klobuchar to join us.
Hello. Can you hear me, Larry?
I can. Thank you so much.
Very good. Well, thank you.
We've got a special welcomer here for you today.
I heard that.
Joan,
you doing okay? Are you wearing your Zoom outfit with like sweatpants underneath your suit? I might be.
I'd like to welcome Joan Gable, President, University of Minnesota.
Oh, hi, President.
Hello, everybody. Gable. Hello, Senator. How are you?
Great.
To see you. Looking very well. I am absolutely honored to be the one to kick off today's event. I'll just share a little personal story. So, you know, I've been in this position for 9 months now, but I was announced in the position, as you all may recall, several months before that. And literally one of the first three people I heard from was Senator Amy Klobuchar, who sent me the nicest note to welcome me to the state and welcome me to advocating on behalf of the state. And she has very quickly become my role model for how to do that selflessly, how to do that with humor, how to do that strategically. As we all know, she's a tireless advocate for the state, but I think she gets, and one of the reasons why we all admire her so much, is that what happens here, if it happens well, has a national and global impact. And I think she's been a tremendous voice for that, for how doing things well in Minnesota means that we serve the whole country and the whole world at the best possible levels. And I know I speak for all of us when I say she has made us so proud in the campaign, so honored to support her in that process, and continues to make us proud in this just crazy time we find ourselves in, as it has affected us as a country, as it has affected her family specifically. And so I'm very pleased to be able to kick it off, and I will turn it over to Larry and the Senator for their remarks. Thank you all very much.
And thank you, President Gable. I know what challenges this is has presented, not only for our state, our country, for every person in our state, but also the University of Minnesota. And we care so much about the university. As you know, my husband's a Prague graduate, as well as my dad. And we're looking forward to helping you in the months to come, because we must keep this university as strong as it is. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay.
And I want to welcome everyone joining us. This is part of a series. The Humphrey School has been convening for some time. We usually do it in person, and Senator Klobuchar has joined us many times at the Humphrey School, which is the School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. I'm Larry Jacobs. I am a professor at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School, the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, which is the organizer of today's event. Senator Klobuchar, how's your husband doing? Let's start off.
Well, he's doing really well. Maybe I can get him to come down here for a second and wave. We'll see. He, as you know, got the coronavirus in a very bad way. He teaches like you do. And he, the day he started feeling sick, it was one of the last days they had a faculty meeting, and he decided not to go. I think a lot of other people would have gotten sick at his school where he teaches. And so he just started being alone in their apartment. I was in Minnesota every day to have a temperature, and it was over 100 every single day. And then finally, he started coughing up blood, and he ended up going into the emergency room. And that's when they found out he had really low oxygen and pneumonia. And so he was in the hospital 5 days with really 70% oxygen, which is bad. And it suddenly turned around, as some of these cases do, on about the fourth day. And then he went back, and he's doing better every single day. And again, is really proud of being a great graduate of the University of Minnesota. It's a big part of his life. He's always wearing University of Minnesota sweatshirts. If we're really lucky, maybe I'll get him to come down here in some garb or something. Has taught some classes as well here and there at the university. So that's where we are now. And having personally experienced it, having waited 6 days for the test, having seen what it's like to not be able to hold the hand of the person you love and hug the healthcare workers that take care of them, it gave me a whole different perspective on this. what so many people are experiencing right now and why we have to zealously look for a vaccine and zealously get more testing in place, not only for people's health, but for our economy, and get the right gear to the healthcare workers. Okay, I think he's lurking. I'm gonna have him say hello. Here he is, and look at the shirt he's wearing. Here he is. See him?
Hey, John, how are you?
Good.
It's good to see you well.
And look at what he's wearing. He's wearing his...
Yeah, I've got my... I'm an alum here, you know, so gopher all the way. So how are you?
Good. We're glad to see you, and we send our best from Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, he was... we were talking about how hard it is that you can't see the person that you love when they're in there. But also one of the cool things about John is that he now has these superpowers with his immunities. So he gets to go out to the grocery store, but he also will be able to give blood.
Right? Yeah, but it was it's a weeks long recovery process for sure. So
yeah, but they're looking at their Mayo and the university are researching things, and this light is how you can give blood once you have the immunities. And so that'll be a silver lining, I guess.
You're gonna be a valuable friend, John.
All right, well, thanks a lot. Enjoy.
Yeah,
all right,
good to see you.
Bye-bye.
And Senator Klobuchar, we have a good friend of yours who's joining us. Mr. Mondale, are you on the phone?
Really?
Yeah, I'm on the phone and I'm trying to talk.
We hear you well.
Amy, before we get into this program, I wanted to say how much I admire what you've been through the last several months. Your campaign was wonderful. You never had a down day. I watched most of those debates. You were always the best participant, strongest participant, and I'm honored to be on the same phone call with you.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Vice President. And you were always so encouraging from the beginning of the campaign. When I will never forget calling him the morning for good luck. And the blizzard was starting to come in, the snow's coming down, and he answers the phone. He may have been in Florida at the time. We'll just let that go. But he answers.
Just keep right on talking.
Yeah, Klobuchar headquarters, Florida branch, Mondale speaking. And then he says to me, "It's snowing up there. You're not going to do that outside." And I go, yeah, that's our only platform. That's our only stage. But he's given me great advice and throughout the thing. And I think it made our campaign so much stronger in having such a wonderful mentor to know how to begin it, but also how to end it. And I felt good about our campaign from the joyful beginning to the joyful end when I endorsed the vice president at that incredible rally in Dallas. So thank you very much.
Hey, Amy, we're proud of you. You're Minnesota's best, and we applaud the results, not the results, but your performance that were so strong.
Mr. Mondale, I want to start out with a question to you about your experience. You, of course, broke the gender barrier when you selected Geraldine Ferraro as your running mate in 1984. And then we had, several other women. John McCain selected a woman as a running mate. And obviously Hillary Clinton was the Democratic Party candidate in 2016. But it's been 36 years since you chose Geraldine Ferraro. Are you surprised that there's not been more progress and success with women running for president?
Well, I'm going to say something, and then I'll probably stop talking. But what worried me about that race was that the normal way that Minnesota's vote was altered, and big parts of the state voted against me that had always voted for me, and then. With this 2016 race, Hillary, I was really surprised by how sexist I thought some of the voters were. I hope I'm wrong. I'm glad to be declared wrong here, but I still think when people come and think about voting for president wrongly, a lot of people can't bring themselves to vote for a woman. I hope that's wrong. I went through this with Kennedy years ago when people say, well, we can't have a Catholic president. Well, we had one that worked out fine. Nobody was hurt. And if we'd have this experience with a good woman president, I think we'd feel the same way once we'd had the experience. But I just say that because it's been a sort of a dispiriting experience.
Senator Klobuchar, were you a bit surprised? You were quite vocal during the debates and in between them, what you saw as kind of a higher standard for women.
Well, first of all, we had some great women running. And I still think that from the minute we had that first debate, we literally doubled. On the first night, there were two debates at the beginning, of course. In one night, we doubled the number of women who had ever been on a primary stage for a Democratic presidential debate. And I think the fact that we were different from different parts of the country, different political views, different backgrounds, I think it was a very, very good thing. And so many people over the course of the year watched those debates and got to know us. So I think in the end, while we were not the ones that were picked by the Democratic primary electorate, I still think it was a very positive thing to have that many women running. I also think that, yes, when you look at the number of women, as I said on the debate stage, if it was all fair, we could play a game called Name Your Favorite Woman President. But that's a game we can't play because there's never been one. And when you look at, and I've studied this in the Senate with so many of my friends, Democrats and Republicans, and there's actually been a study out of Harvard, the University of Minnesota of the East, that supports this. And that is that the women senators work together better, they pass bills together more, they tend to be very focused on accountability. And someone once said, and I don't agree with the first part of this, I agree with the second, that women candidates speak softly, I don't agree with that, and carry a big statistic. And I think what was meant by that was this sense of accountability. So I still think that we advanced the cause greatly. You've seen huge strides for women elected to mayor's offices and now some governors, and then certainly in the Congress, where we're now up over 25%. And that's a big shift from where we even were 5 years ago.
Mr. Mondale, you were obviously twice involved in the vice presidential selection process. Once when you were chosen by Jimmy Carter, and then in 84, when you ran your own. Put us into Joe Biden's circle right now. What are they thinking about? What are some of the considerations that they're weighing?
Well, I was glad to see him say the other day publicly that he was going to pick a woman running mate. I think that's the way it should be now. Later, I don't know, but it put the focus on the process of picking the best woman candidate and picking one that would help Biden win the presidency. And they're not talking about this much, but I wish they would, about the help a president needs from a vice president. It's not just getting elected. If you don't do that, you don't have anything. It's also governing. And so I hope this is indeed I hope it is. It's the beginning of a serious process of learning and deciding who could best help the president govern, get elected, and then govern.
So, Mr. Monda, you alluded to this, but there's two eras of vice presidential candidates. There's the before Mondale era, in which the vice president was as one of your predecessors put it, standby material.
Yeah.
And then there's the Mondale and on with Democrat and Republican, in which the vice president becomes a critical part of the process for governing, and it varied across presidents. Amy Klobuchar, what do you see as the critical qualifications that a vice president would bring to a Biden presidency if they were to get elected?
Well, I think that, first of all, you have to have someone, and the Vice President Mondale knows this more than anyone, that is actually going to govern and help govern. And I think that Vice President Biden has a lot of great people to pick from. And I think he will be the one that will ultimately know the best. He, like Vice President Mondale, was a very good vice president to Barack Obama. And he'll make that decision based on who he thinks is best. And I think that's what's the most important. Someone he's comfortable with, someone who can help him campaign, can help him win. So that's where I am on that. There's many good people to pick from.
Senator Klobuchar, you've been one of the leaders in Congress and a point person in the Senate on elections. And you've been particularly concerned about elections during a pandemic. You were making the argument for substantial expenditures recommended by experts in the election field so that we could survive the pandemic and have a robust election. Where are we, in your view, in terms of creating an election process for November that's both safe and vigorous?
I'm leading the bill in the Senate that would make that happen with Senator Ron Wyden. And anyone that saw the photos and the videos of those lines in Wisconsin, where voters were standing in line wearing masks when they didn't have to, because in this case, the Republican legislature wouldn't give the governor a delay in the election, and simply to exercise their right to vote, they were literally risking their own lives. To me, it was an absolute outrage. So many of them African American that were standing in those lines. To make matters worse, they didn't even allow, because of a court decision, the time to be extended to get absentee ballots. When you look at the right to vote, it is fundamental in this country, and there is a way to fix this. That is by allowing more extensive voting at home and mail-in ballots. That's what our bill does. We've got $400 million set aside in the last package, and I'm working on even more. This afternoon, I am actually doing a call with Republican and Democratic Secretary of States from all over the country who support getting this funding, and so that will be key. The other thing to remember, and the estimates are over $2 billion, the other thing to remember is that we also need to make it easier for people to go to the polls. Only 25% of Americans vote by mail right now. Some states it's really high, like Oregon, Colorado, Utah, it's red and blue states, Arizona, Nevada. But in other states it's 2 to 3 to 4%. And so we understand that not everyone's gonna vote by mail. And that's why part of this funding would be to get polls open for 20 days in advance all over the country so people don't congregate. And then also training a whole new generation of poll workers who won't be as vulnerable to this disease. We don't know where the disease and the virus is gonna be by November, but we do know by most estimates, unless there is something cataclysmically good happens, it will still be around in some form. And so the hope here is that we get our act together, we get the money out, we work with Secretary of States, and we do what we can to set some standards for the country. And that's what we're trying to do. The thought that Donald Trump is sitting in the White House ordering a mail-in ballot for himself and his wife, that's what they've just done, from Palm Beach, while that nurse in Milwaukee is standing in line with a mask on just to vote, is something and an image that I hope Americans won't forget. He should be strongly supporting Republican and Democratic Secretary of States who want to vastly expand vote at home.
As you saw yesterday, the president came out and said that vote by mail is an invitation for fraud and cheating, and that if vote by mail or vote by home were to be adopted more widely, Republicans would never win an election again.
You know, first of all, when you look at the stats, and you're a great professor and scholar of political science, it's really interesting. The vote by mail states, as I mentioned, the high level vote by mail ones are all over the place. Oregon, I guess, is a more blue state. Colorado is clearly a purple state. They have one Democratic, one Republican senator. The state of Utah is known as pretty red. So I guess when he's talking about fraud, he's criticizing his own voters in what has been a predominantly Republican state, maybe not this time. Arizona and Nevada are not, they're over, I think, 80% vote by mail. Minnesota's like at 25, we're in the middle. And 2 million people in the military cast their votes by mail. So I don't know what he is talking about when it's been very successful in many states. And at least you have a backup or an actual paper ballot when people vote by mail. And so you actually eliminate some of the hacking concerns.
Do you find much support among your colleagues on the other side of the aisle for vote by mail and other steps to try to make voting safe and vigorous in November?
Yes, there have been a number of Republicans that have supported this funding. We wouldn't have been able to get $400 million in the last bill if that wasn't the case. Now, some of them do not support some of the provisions that we think would be most helpful for the country, which is having a standard during the pandemic of the 20 days early voting, making sure that it's easy to register to get those ballots and the like. But individual states can do that as well, in addition to us continuing to try to do it on a federal level.
So you're kind of hoping that the states will do what they can on their own, and then the federal government is coming in and as a partner.
The federal government can come in with funding, and hopefully we could get a few of these standards into law, given what a fiasco we just saw in Wisconsin. So we are continuing to try that. But at the same time, the states, many of them are looking at their own rules, including in Minnesota. 12 states require a witness to get a mail-in ballot, and 6 of those states, half of them, require 2 witnesses or a notary. I heard this story the other day of someone trying to get their absentee ballot while they were in a hospital room with coronavirus, and they had to have a notary outside of a window. Like, this is just not where we should be during a pandemic. It's funny, but in a very macabre way. It's ridiculous. And so those states, hopefully their Secretary of States will be looking at making changes to the rules and just making it easier. Some states are almost all mail-in ballot. Everyone, that's what Oregon's like. But we have to be cognizant of the fact that you still have to have polls open, because people with disabilities, many of them can't do the mail-in ballots. People are not in the whole country going to make that transition, the 75% that vote by polls, in just 8 months. And so you've got to expand the mail-in ballots greatly, but still make sure the polling is as safe as possible. And early voting is the safest way to do it, because you get less people on any single moment.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Monda, I want to turn to another topic that you've worked on very
Talk
hard.
To Amy, just
Yes, sir.
Can I talk to Amy just a second about a question?
Oh, okay. This will be harder than any of Larry's questions.
Yeah. No, we have I think maybe the best state administration of elections, and our
Steve Simon, our great secretary.
Steve Simon is magnificent, and he's been head of our state election system for about a decade, and he works closely with Republicans. He said, I don't want anything that hasn't been approved by Republicans, and I think we've done a very fine job there. And am I not right that Steve is one of the most impressive members of the state structure? And could we hope for more momentum coming out at the state level than we've been used to as a result of that?
Yes, and he's actually going to be on our call today with 10 leaders, Secretary of States, including, by the way, the Republican Secretary of State in Washington State and in West Virginia and other places. So the Secretary of States are on a common ground. when it comes to expanding vote by mail and getting more funding. Steve's actually trying to make it even more prevalent in our state. And the vice president's right. We have the highest voter turnout in the country last time. And we've always done it as a combination of male votes, not male, female, vote by mail votes, as well as the early voting and then the voting same day registration, the day of the polls. So, you know, we hope things are going to be better by then, but Minnesotans may have to adjust and hopefully vote by mail more and do the early voting more, just so that we can make it as safe as possible. And I know that's, I've talked to Steve and we're working together on this.
And this is, of course, a huge
challenge. Thank you.
It's a huge challenge for all secretaries of state because the transition from vote in person to vote by mail is complicated. Mm-hmm. Washington State, which is entirely vote by mail, took 5 years.
Yeah.
So this is a big job, and I know you're trying to help the states and give them some latitude to work in, but...
Yeah, that's why we have to be very honest and practical about it. Yeah. But at the same time, voters want to vote, and we've got to give them options here.
Senator Klobuchar, I want to shift to another topic. Obviously, Congress has passed 3 stimulus bills related to coronavirus. There's a 4th that's being talked about. And one of the concerns, and I think this is not partisan, is about accountability. Senator Grassley has been one of the most vocal members of Congress in terms of the Inspector General process for a number of years. He's expressed concern about the treatment of inspectors general by President Trump. As Congress and as you are looking at the possibly 4th coronavirus stimulus package, is there a tension on accountability?
Well, of course there is. There's a lot of money going out and it needs to go out to everything from our local governments to hospitals and to first responders, those on the front line, to the work that's being done with small businesses. There has to be accountability when trillions of dollars is going out. And we worked very hard to make the bill so much stronger, not only for the frontline workers and small businesses, but also to have more accountability built in. And that accountability rests in Congress, yes, but it also rests with these inspector generals. So something that may have gotten lost in the news for some people because everyone is rightfully focused on their own survival right now, but something that may have gotten lost in the news is that Glenn Fine, who is well-respected inspector general, worked through the Bush administration, the Obama administration, now the Trump administration, headed up the head inspector general at various times for the Justice Department and the Defense Department. Those are huge jobs where he's analyzing, providing oversight of spending both administrations. He was the one that all the inspector generals, when they met, they said, yeah, he's the guy that should head this up. They decided on him and Trump fired him from that job. That was one of the scariest things that happened last week in the middle of, you know, complete factual errors and other things that were said, is that if there is not oversight over this money, this process will not go well, because you've got to know that someone smart is looking over your shoulder and making sure that money is going out and it's spent right. You combine that with the threat to our democracy right now. There is a reason that some of us are looking not just at the moment of, yes, get the testing out, yes, get the protective equipment out, but we also have to look over the horizon to, let's make sure this money is spent well so it actually helps our economy so that we can have a vast majority of people back to work by next year. Let's make sure we have a functioning democracy. And those are the things that I'm focused on.
Thank you very much. I know you have to run to your next appointment. It was great to have you. Mr. Mondale, do you want to share a parting word?
Just thank you, Amy, for everything. I'm with you all the way.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Vice President. Just say, stay safe. I know you're doing all your, I'm sure in your Scandinavian ways, that social distancing is okay with you.
I'm very good at it.
But we all love you very much. And just so glad that I didn't know you were going to be on this call. I know you've done these events before with Professor Jacobs, and it's just an honor to have you on. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Klobuchar.
Thank you.
We've got a second half here, so don't go anywhere. I want to welcome Jennifer Lawless to our conversation. Jennifer Lawless is a professor at the University of Virginia. She's a political scientist, and she's an expert in women and elections. And she'll be joining the conversation with Vice President Mondale, both on what we heard from Senator Klobuchar, as well as we're picking up your questions. If you'd like to ask questions, there's a feature at the bottom of your screen. If you move your cursor down there, you'll see Q&A. Put your questions there. We're going to get to as many as we possibly can. Jennifer Lawless, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me just start off with, what did you hear that struck you as interesting?
Well, I think the biggest thing was the fact that it's now 2020, and since 1984, we've been pushing as a country to see whether we can actually have a woman either as vice president or president, and we seem to be coming up short. The good news about 2020, of course, is that Joe Biden has pledged to put a woman on the ticket. So if he wins this election, that glass ceiling will finally be cracked. But it's just striking to me that decades after the Mondale-Ferraro ticket, we're still having the same kinds of conversations.
Do you think the reason for that has something to do with the attitudes towards women, what they're capable of, their skill set, their suitability? Is there something that voters, or maybe the process, is doing that's treating male presidential candidates differently from female candidates?
Well, the good news is that if you look beyond the presidency, there doesn't seem to be any systematic bias against female candidates. There are always examples of sexism and gender bias and discrimination, but systematically, when women run for office, they are just as likely as to win, they raise just as much money. Even media coverage nowadays looks very similar. The presidential level is a little bit different because we have such a wide media environment. You have so many people following what's going on, and it's also the highest position in the land. The problem in identifying whether it's explicit sexism or not is that we've still had so few women in this position that it's difficult to draw broad conclusions. So when we look at 2016, for example, we don't really know whether Hillary Clinton's loss had more to do with sexism or what I call Clintonism, which is that she was in the public eye for a quarter of a century. Many people didn't like her or had qualms about her, not necessarily because she was a woman, but because of other factors. So it's really hard to know. I take solace in knowing, however, that she did receive more votes than Donald Trump. So at least in terms of the American public, people are clearly willing to cast ballots for a female presidential candidate.
Senator Klobuchar said with regards to Pete Buttigieg's candidate that no woman would have been allowed on the stage if they had his experience, meaning experience of being a mayor who received, you know, about 11,000 votes. Is that a fair criticism?
Oh, I would say that no woman would have the audacity to put herself on the stage. So I don't know that it's a matter of the voters would have said, absolutely not, this is terrible, we're not going to give you the level of support required to have a space on that stage. I think that women tend to hold themselves to a higher standard. We know that's the case when they think about running for office in the first place. A man who doesn't think he's qualified to run for office still has a significant shot of throwing his hat into the ring for local or state positions. Women just don't do that. And so if women are holding themselves to a higher standard, it's not that surprising that the women on the stage often seemed a bit more credentialed and qualified than some of the men.
There was some concern during the Democratic presidential contest that the idea of electability was being defined in a way and framed in a way that wasn't fair to women. Does that make sense to you?
So I'm one of these political scientists that hates the word electability because I think it means to people whatever they want to justify supporting the candidate they like in the first place. And so in this particular case, electability was seen as who could defeat Donald Trump. And the basic juxtaposition for all of these candidates was to to Donald Trump in 2016. So I think people looked around and said, well, you know, Hillary Clinton had a tough time and he really was very unfair to her. And as a result, we need the opposite of Hillary Clinton. So we certainly cannot have a woman. I'm not sure that those voters wouldn't have come up with another reason to support their candidate, not gender related. It's just one of these situations where people think that the candidate they are supporting is the one who's the most likely to win the election. And then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay. There were, of course, organizations and people who were quite prominent who have taken a position supporting women for president. Emily's List being one. They didn't endorse until a few days before really the end of the process. Hillary Rodham Clinton was silent in terms of her endorsement. Did that strike you as a bit odd that at least the kind of firepower from areas that might have supported the president, a female presidential candidate, did not come forward?
Not particularly. There were a couple of factors at play. The first is the 2020 presidential election is different, I think, than previous presidential elections in that most organized interest groups, most political elites, and even voters themselves have placed defeating Donald Trump at the top of the list when it comes to their goals. And so even an organization like Emily's List that supports pro-choice female candidates, and there were certainly pro-choice female candidates on that stage, decided, and people like Hillary Clinton have probably decided as well, that the most important thing they can do is support the eventual nominee without having their words used against them. So by supporting any of these other women in the process, if that person hadn't ultimately emerged as the nominee, that could potentially fracture support or lead to criticism of the eventual nominee. So I just think the dynamics this time around were a little bit different. Remember, in 2004, I think, the National Organization for Women supported and endorsed early on Carol Moseley Braun, who had a very low chance of winning the nomination. So I think it really just shows that this cycle, things are a little bit different.
We have a number of questions, and I've been picking up some of them. Here's one. Other countries have been more successful with electing or appointing or nominating women. Is there something specific to America that has made this harder?
The biggest difference between the United States and a lot of the nations, the more than 70 actually, who have a higher percentage of women in the national legislature or as heads of state, are that we don't have any quotas and we don't have a very, very entrepreneurial candidate emergence process, which means that a person has to decide to run for office and build a campaign infrastructure all on his or her own. And that means raising money, developing supporters, and those are backgrounds, qualifications, and credentials that men still have an advantage on. So that's part of it. The other piece of this is that the best way to identify a credible candidate is to look at somebody who's already held office. So when we're thinking about presidential candidates, we're looking at governors and we're looking at senators and members of Congress. When we're thinking about congressional candidates, we look to state legislatures, mayors, city councilors. And across the board, women remain significantly underrepresented in all of those positions. So although the bench is now becoming a little bit more occupied, and although we have more women running, they're still far from even 40% of the potential candidates out there when we think quickly about who might be president.
Jennifer Lawless, thank you for joining us, University of Virginia. Let's turn to the question of, does it matter to voters if a woman is on the ticket with Joe Biden? What do we know about the impact of having a woman as a candidate on the behavior of voters?
The evidence is mixed. At the congressional level and for some high-profile Senate races, there's evidence to suggest that when there's a female candidate that can drive up enthusiasm and knowledge about a race, it doesn't disproportionately send women to the polls, but it does up voter turnout. And given that this would be on the Democratic side of the aisle, it would increase voter turnout among Democrats, which would ultimately help the ticket. There's other evidence to suggest that it doesn't really matter in terms of the outcome, but it does matter in terms of sending a signal to the broader populace that this party actually embraces the values that it has said it embraces. And when you have a Democratic Party where you had all of these candidates on the stage who
who represented diverse backgrounds. I think it's important this time around to have a ticket that somehow reflects that so that voters don't feel like they've been disregarded or dismissed, even if their candidate didn't become the president, the presidential candidate on the top of the ticket.
We've got a question here about Nikki Haley. This is a rumor that Donald Trump would drop Vice President Pence and instead bring Nikki Haley on his ticket for 2020. I don't frankly know if that's true or not, but let's just speculate about it for a second. Just taking what you just said, would it be a smart political move by Donald Trump to have a woman on the ticket, particularly someone who's prominent and broadly respected like Nikki Haley?
I don't think it matters. And the reason I don't think it matters is twofold. First, voters are, especially in presidential elections, almost always going to vote for the candidate who shares their party identification. This has been the case over time. So even in 2016, when both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had the most unfavorable ratings among their co-partisans as any presidential candidates ever had, 9 out of 10 Democrats still supported Clinton and 9 out of 10 Republicans still supported Trump. So people don't cross party lines, or very few of them do. When it comes to independents, that's where the movement matters. And it's hard to imagine, given how everybody understands quite clearly the way that Donald Trump manages the presidency, that putting Nikki Haley on the ticket would in some way fundamentally change his values or his positions or his rhetoric or his style. So it's unlikely that those independents who voted for Trump the last time around, who are now thinking about Biden, would be pulled back to Trump simply because there was a woman on the ticket. The upside could be generating enthusiasm among Republican women who might otherwise stay home.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Mondale, can I bring you back on?
Well, I wanted to ask a question of Jennifer, if I might. Had there been any surveys or polls of public views about having a strong woman for president? All those words are important to me. I mean, I think the public has accepted the value and the possibilities of women in state and congressional offices. I think where the hang-up is in the presidential and vice presidential offices. Why, I don't know, but and I'm not sure I'm right in this, but I certainly sensed a reluctance to vote for Geraldine, a reluctance that I thought I saw with Amy, their candidate for president last time, Hillary Clinton. I just wanted to know whether there's been any kind of sophisticated testing of the public on that issue.
There have. So there have been two sets of questions. The first, Gallup has actually asked now for 50 or 60 years, and the question is terrible. It's, would you be willing to vote for a woman if your party nominated her and she were otherwise qualified for the job? So in order to say no to that, you basically have to be a card-carrying sexist, because who's willing to cross party lines? But, you know, in the 1960s and the 1970s, you still had a third of people saying, yeah, no, I'm not going to vote for that woman. Over time, that has trended upward. By the 1980s, we were at about 75 or 80% of people saying they were willing to support a female presidential candidate. And now that number is about 95 or 96%. There's obviously a social desirability component where people know that if they say no to that, they seem sexist. So there's this other question that pollsters ask also, which is, do you think your friends and neighbors would be willing to vote for a female presidential candidate? And there, only about 50% of people say yes. So I think you're exactly right that there is this reluctance. People are unwilling to admit that they have that sense because they think it's unappealing and wrong, but they are likely to assume that people around them won't vote for a woman. Because they assume that people around them won't vote for a woman, that then plays into their own definition of electability. And as a result, they often wind up not voting for the female presidential candidate because they don't think that she's electable.
So Jennifer Lawless, what you're saying, I think, is that the most politic way or easiest path to bring a woman into the White House is the one that Walter Mondale started in 84, which was the vice presidential candidate. John McCain brought Sarah Palin onto the ticket, and now Joe Biden is going to select a woman. And the idea here would be bring a woman into the White House as a vice president. Country would get used to her. They would become presumably comfortable, confident in that person, and then they might have a shot at running for president themselves. Is that, does that scenario sound maybe more politically feasible?
That's the scenario I think is the most likely path to a female president. The only alternative would be if Donald Trump wins re-election in 2020 and then both parties nominate a woman in 2024. So that at that point takes gender out of the equation entirely, and the nation's going to be stuck with a female presidential candidate. You can imagine many on the Democratic side who are planning to run in that scenario, and Nikki Haley and others who would have a very good chance at garnering the nomination for the GOP.
Mr. Mondale, I want to see if I get you back on the phone again. Thank you. I've got a question here that I've been wondering about, and you're really the ideal person to ask it. We've got so much going on this year in terms of the presidential election that I would say falls in the disaster category. The coronavirus has unleashed a deathly cloud over us. You've got our economy in a tailspin. You've got our healthcare system, on the cusp of collapsing, and on and on. Have you seen an election, at least in your lifetime, that's been as has kind of haunted by these sort of mega tragedies and controversies and crises?
I would say I haven't seen this array of deep problems confronting the American electorate in a presidential election. We shall see, as the president liked to say. I think a lot of this, some of this may shake out. These disputes around absentee ballot, I find ridiculous. You got to have a good absentee ballot, but there should be no generic objection to the absentee ballot, particularly when our nation is being paralyzed by this coronavirus. I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the only period I can think of that comes close to this is the one you lived through and you were quite involved in, namely the Vietnam War and the protests and then the Watergate episode, kind of this, you really felt like the foundations of the country were cracking. This seems, more encompassing in a way because it's hitting people, in our homes and our families.
Yes. I'm an old optimist on this stuff. I've been through so much in a public position, and I've seen it sort out. I've seen the public sort of rise to the occasion when higher challenges are around. The Americans love their democracy. They don't want to lose it. They're not going to let anybody take it away from them. They're going to judge candidates by their commitment to democracy and be influenced by that heavily. And so basically put me down as one who thinks that the country can work its way through all these problems. Maybe there's one I haven't seen yet that they can't handle. So I don't want to sound cocky or certain, but thus far, the American people have done very well with these issues.
Thank you. Jennifer Lawless, would you expect a drop in turnout in 2020, just given what you know today?
I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to what the election processes look like between now and November. So I would have, had the coronavirus not happened, expected record turnout in 2020, given what we saw in 2018, and also given what we saw in the 2017 and 2019 off-year state elections. Now we're actually asking people to put their right to vote to the test where it could compromise their health. And if we are not in a position where absentee ballots are available, where early voting is available, and where we've definitely not only flattened the curve, but have seen a substantial reduction in the probability of a second wave of this virus in the fall, you know, then I think turnout will be high. Otherwise, it's really an unknown. You know, it's hard enough to get people to vote and to get them to know that the stakes matter so much. We've never before had to do that where it's also been asking them to put their own health on the line.
Yeah, and you went through quite a list there of conditions that would have to be met to have high turnout. Let's start with the one that Senator Klobuchar has been working on, and Republicans. This is not a partisan issue, despite what the president said, which is vote by mail or vote by home. There are Republican states that do quite a bit of vote by mail. And the question, at least in Washington, that I have for you, Jennifer Lawless, is this. The coronavirus has most publicly hit Democratic areas so far, New York being the primary one. And if you're sitting in the South in a town, maybe your reaction is, okay, well, that's New York. But now, at least in the last week, we're starting to see the coronavirus spread out. We're starting to see concentrations of illness in southern towns. And some places, the intensity, that is the number of people who are ill to the population, is higher than in New York and actually other places of the world. Do you think as that reality begins to set in on Washington, that we might see a broader coalition of Democrats and Republicans looking at vote by mail and other ways to make elections both safe and vigorous?
I do, but I should also note that I'm actually in New York. I'm with my parents in New York and have been for the last few weeks, and I'm going to be here for the long haul. And so I do look at the Charlottesville newspaper every day. I look at what's going on in Charlottesville and in and around the university. And there's been a clear shift in terms of the efforts that a lot of these places that are not epicenters right now are taking as the virus becomes more and more real to them. And so I would not be surprised if over the course of the next few weeks or even months, there is a shift. The question is it going to be too late? And that's what becomes so tricky when you have a president and a highly polarized Congress and a pretty polarized public trying to make this seem like it's a partisan issue. By the time everybody's on board, it may be too difficult to change the rules and the laws governing what actually happens in November.
As you know, one of the pockets of voters who overall, not entirely, but the kind of balance who support Republicans are seniors, 65 and older. Tends to be, not uniformly, but tends to be a good pocket of support for Republicans. And as you start thinking about some of the swing states can be fought over, like Florida, you can see the point. The reality of seniors who are in a high-risk group turning out to vote in a pandemic, is that going to sink in with Republicans and say, hey, this is not about Democrats getting away with something. This is about, you know, having a fair shot to get our voters out to the polls.
I think it's an open question. I mean, the person who's most likely to be able to take the lead on an issue like that is the governor of Florida, who's also been incredibly reluctant to close the beaches. So, you know, I think that all of this is grounded in a broader discussion about the extent to which both parties are willing to move away from some of their traditional positions on issues of voting and access to ensure that we have a presidential election that's as fair and inclusive as it can be at a time when the outside conditions are doing everything they possibly can to keep that from happening.
There's a question here from one of our viewers. How will the pandemic influence public opinion and policy around healthcare?
It's interesting. You know, when Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden had their last debate, it seemed somewhat tone deaf to me that Sanders was talking about how this entire thing highlights the importance of Medicare for all, because it seemed like we were at a point where people just wanted reassurance. They weren't getting that reassurance from President Trump. And so they were looking to the Democrats to tell them that everything was going to be okay, and there could be a policy discussion and debate later. Now, I actually think that what this has done is highlight the importance of a healthcare system that can deal with conditions that we never thought we would have to endure. And as a result, I think it's going to turn public opinion, especially among people who may have been reticent to say that the government should interfere in their healthcare, toward Medicare for all or similar options. That actually puts Joe Biden in a better position in terms of the way that he can court and cultivate support among Bernie Sanders and his supporters.
This is actually one of the areas I've done a lot of research, and I generally agree with what you just said. In fact, I think if you look at what's happened, we're seeing Congress providing more support in terms of funding that is backing up the Affordable Care Act. President Trump quite publicly said he wouldn't extend the sign-up period for insurance exchanges, okay? But the reality is, if you're uninsured and have kind of a change of life circumstances, that's the key legal phrase, you can then apply for subsidies to get private health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And I predict millions of Americans will actually do that. We're already starting to see thousands of people doing it around the country. So at the end of this, regardless of whatever happens with single payer, I think the government's involvement in healthcare is larger, and it's gonna kind of reframe the debate in very significant ways. And again, this is something Republicans are starting to come on board with. Mr. Mondale, we're running out of time. I wanna just bring you back in if I could. You know, I see a lot of people, and I get this question all the time, and I'm sure you do. Do you have hope for the future? You've got students who are just, you know, beside themselves with their dreams and plans that are on hold. I've got, people I know or get in touch with me who are older and just worried about what's going to happen to them.
Well, the issue that seems to dominate that is the Medicare issue, senior health care for senior citizens. Despite all the politics I hear, seniors do not want Medicare tampered with. Their lives are now dependent in part on good health care. Healthcare availability and costs are a central part of seniors, well, of everybody's life, but of seniors' life particularly. And it drives our politics. I'm amazed at the number of seniors that tell me that this is the issue. This is what they're worried about. And the polls sort of show that too, as far as I can tell. Everybody's voted on Medicare, but seniors are hard over on the question. So I would say we need to keep Medicare in good shape, maybe Medicare for all, but I don't know what that means. I think just keep improving it, protecting it, expanding it where you're sure it's going to work. We got to be careful not to make mistakes with Medicare. It's so important. I'm sitting here 92 years of age, and this is one of the issues. I know what I'm talking about. Healthcare costs are really awesome for senior citizens. Yeah. And I think we got to be very careful about it.
Mr. Mondale, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're...
Thank you so much for this hour. I think wonderful, and your presentations, as always, are great, and I'm proud to be able to work with you.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it, and stay well. Please stay well.
Good, I will. I will, I promise.
Jennifer Lawless, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you. We'll have you back soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I want to let everyone know that this program was recorded. We'll send out the link to it. We have upcoming events you might want to know about. One of the big issues is, why do Democrats and Republicans hate each other? Well, we have one of the top experts in the country, Stanford political scientist Shanto Iyengar, will be joining us to talk about that, as well as some special guests. April 23rd, all these programs are at noon Central Time. Please join us for that. If you're interested in the vote by mail during a pandemic, we're going to have one of the top experts in the country with us, and that'll be May 5th, again, noon Central Time. And then talk about the emerging presidential race now that the race has settled down between Biden and Trump. We've got Vin Weber, well-known Republican strategist and former Minnesota congressman. He'll be joined by Anna Greenberg, who's a well-known Democratic strategist and well-respected. Both are good friends of mine and will be joining us May 19th, again, noon Central. We'll get more information out about that. Again, I want to thank Jennifer Lawless, Mr. Mondale. I want to particularly thank Lee Chittenden and Mike Carey, who literally are responsible for putting this together. Thank you to both of you, and have a good day. Bye.